From the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College, this is the Candidate Forum on Business and the Economy, sponsored by Lincoln Financial Group, produced in partnership with the Business and Industry Association of New Hampshire, New Hampshire Union Leader, New Hampshire Public Radio, and New Hampshire Public Television.
And welcome to the Candidate Forum on Business and the Economy. I'm Laura Canoy, host of New Hampshire Public Radio's The Exchange. We're coming to you from the television studio at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics and Political Library at St. Anselm College. For the next hour, we'll hear from the candidates for the second congressional district. We will press them to talk about what they would do as members of Congress and refrain from spending valuable time attacking each other. And now let me introduce our candidates. They are incumbent Republican Charlie Bass and Democrat Ann McLean Custer. Our panelists are Phil Vaughn from the New Hampshire Public Television and Mike Cody from the New Hampshire Union Leader. Now, during the first half of our forum, the panelists will ask questions. Then we'll move on to our lightning round, where candidates will provide brief and decisive responses to a series of topics. Then I'll take over and moderate a two-way discussion between the candidates. Some of these questions came from our readers, listeners, and viewers. Each candidate will have 2 minutes for a response, and if there's a follow-up question, 1 minute for that. We tossed a coin earlier to see who would receive the first question, and that question goes to Mr. Bass. And on our panel, we'll begin with Mike Cody from the Union Leader. Mike?
Mr. Bass, you've been in support of extending all of the Bush-era tax cuts. However, the Bush years started with a major tax cut, and yet income growth for most people stagnated during that period. What does that say about tax cuts?
Well, thanks for your question. First of all, thanks to the sponsors of this forum opportunity to get together. I will preface by saying I've known my friend Annie Custer for virtually my whole life, and I do hope that this next hour can be a discussion about substantive issues Excellent. And differences that we have and won't get to a personal level. I wouldn't want to see that happen. As far as the Bush tax cuts are concerned, one needs to remember that back in the early 2000s, the economy was in some danger, nothing like we're facing today. But certainly after 9/11, there were some real issues associated with the ability of the United States to recover from the situation it was in. And I supported those tax relief measures, and I think they were partially responsible, at least, for the economic boom that we had in the mid-2000s. I do support extending all of them. However, I also believe that what we really should do is to fold the issue of extending the early 2000 or the Bush tax cuts into a much larger debate about fundamental tax reform. Fundamental tax reform that will make our nation more competitive globally, that will make it possible for us to make taxes simpler, may raise some rates in some areas, lower in others. But to have this campaign dogma about raising taxes on those making more than $250,000 a year really doesn't help the economy recover, but it certainly does create good campaign fodder. I believe that we need to act in a bipartisan fashion, working Republicans and Democrats together, understanding our differences on this issue, and try to come up with a more fundamental plan for tax reform that will make the U.S. more competitive globally.
And how does the deficit reduction fall into that plan, Mr. Bass?
Well, tax reform and deficit reduction go hand in hand. I think that a comprehensive bipartisan plan for deficit reduction that addresses, for the first time in 30-some-odd years, the issue of entitlement reform, which is 66% of total spending, that the two have to be linked together. Because in the past, some have wanted tax increases without spending reductions, and others have wanted spending reductions without tax reform. I believe that the two have to go together, but let me emphasize that it isn't going to happen either the Republican way or the Democratic way. It has to happen with both of us working together.
Ms. Custer, many economists suggest that if you raise taxes on affluent households, it will cut back on spending, which will further stagnate the economy. Also, this tax hike may discourage small businesses from hiring. So is this the right time to raise taxes?
The truth is that, and again, thank you to all the sponsors, and I appreciate it. And yes, Congressman Bass, this won't be personal. The campaign is not. It's our point of view that's very different and where the country is headed. And this is really one of the fundamental differences between us. My sense is that these are challenging times. We have to get serious about the deficit, and that it's not serious to give millionaires and billionaires an additional tax break. And I think that we do need to cut the deficit. We can't afford $1 trillion in tax relief to the wealthiest members of our society. Everyone will continue to get the tax break up to $250,000 in income. And frankly, in New Hampshire, that's a comfortable style of living. And I think above and beyond that, millionaires are willing to contribute and that they need to. The other piece about this is that you cited economists, but the reality is we've tried this, and for Congressman Bass or any of the Republicans to double down on trickle down, we know it doesn't work. If it worked, we wouldn't be in this position. We've had these tax breaks for millionaires for a long time now, and frankly, they're not creating jobs. So 98% of Americans will get tax relief, 97% of small businesses will get tax relief, but honestly, if we're serious about cutting deficits, excuse me, we cannot afford the $1 trillion break for millionaires.
On that same subject, if wealthy individuals need to pay more, by how much? President Obama suggests raising the tax rate to 39.6%. Is that the fairest rate for upper-income Americans to pay? Give us a number.
What I would do is go back to the Clinton-era tax rates, which we had a big boom in the economy at that point. We created 23 million jobs. And so I think most Americans would be very comfortable returning to that tax rate and making sure that, you know, as I say, everyone in the economy will get that tax break up to $250,000 in income. And that's a comfortable standard of living here in New Hampshire. And beyond that, I think people are willing to pay their fair share.
Okay. Mr. Bass, you want to jump
back
in there?
If I could just briefly comment, it isn't about millionaires versus everybody else. It's about getting this economy turned around again. And I would only point out that raising taxes in the middle of this recession without having any comprehensive plan to turn the economy around is a bad idea. And there needs to be a bigger debate here about comprehensive tax reform, and the dogma of the campaign about the rich versus the poor. This is about the economy, and we're here to talk about getting the economy turned around. And I'd only point out that the president's tax hike proposal — it's not a tax break, it's a tax hike — to 39.5% would only pay for about a fifth of all the spending proposals that he's proposed so far this year. It's not about deficit reduction. It's about paying for bigger government.
Ms. Custer, you have
45 seconds. Here's my issue with the congressman's position on this. If these resources were being used to create new jobs, then the small business wouldn't be paying taxes on them. That's a deduction. If you hire new people, that's a deduction. So taxes are paid on the net. And the point is that these people with this kind of income right now are not putting the money back into the economy. They're not hiring new people. Frankly, they're not even buying new goods. We know that this money is outside of the economy right now. It's on hold. And it's the uncertainty from Congress that's causing people to stay out of the,
okay,
out of the
economy. Our next question comes from Phil Vaughn from New Hampshire Public Television. Go ahead, Phil.
Ms. Custer, New Hampshire's biggest manufacturing employer, BAE Systems of Nashua, could be hurt badly if automatic defense spending cuts go through. If you want to save those New Hampshire jobs and keep those contracts coming to BAE, where specifically in the defense budget would you cut?
Well, first of all, thank you for bringing up BAE, which is one of the largest employers in the 2nd Congressional District. Congressman Bass and others voted for this sequester, and I was particularly surprised to see them at BAE last week worrying about the defense cuts, knowing that they had voted that way. Where I would cut, if we need cuts in the defense budget, which I think we do in order to tackle these deficits, I would cut redundant weapon systems. I would look at the 800 sites that we have all around the world to see if we can afford that many locations at this point. But I would not cut the services and the goods that are created at BAE, which have to do with protecting our troops. I think we need to protect the troops, Personally, I don't want us to go to war. I want to bring the troops home from Afghanistan and be nation building right here at home. But I do believe in the goods and services that are created there that are about protecting the lives of those that are in harm's way.
President Obama and Jeanne Shaheen both supported the Budget Control Act. Did they make a mistake?
No, I think my own problem is this is the dysfunction in Congress. Congress is broken. The American people know that. It's the institution with the lowest approval rating in our society. And this fiscal cliff and the whole sequester is an indication that people are not taking the deficit seriously, and they're just kicking the can down the road and creating crisis conditions in order to make even common sense solutions.
And Phil, I know you need to go to Mr. Bass, but Ms. Custer, so did Senator Shaheen and President Obama make a mistake by signing on to this thing?
I think at the time people thought it would work, but in order to do that, they needed to sit down and be working since then. And the reality is that Speaker Boehner has refused to sit down and actually have meaningful discussions and negotiations that would get us to where we need to be, and now we're back in crisis mode. And this particular Congress, we've been in crisis mode every few weeks, it seems.
All right. Go ahead, Phil.
Mr. Bass, same question
sure.
to you. If you want to save these jobs and you want the contracts to continue to be a where in the defense budget would you cut?
Well, first of all, I can't believe that, Annie, that you would have voted against the Budget Control Act. Any responsible legislator, although we all have our own views, I believe that the specter of having the U.S. go into default would have been much more serious than anything that could have accrued. And the sequester was designed to try to get at the process of cutting spending. Republicans appointed, I think, pretty good people to that so-called super committee. The Democrats appointed the head of the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee and the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee, the most political positions in the whole Congress. And frankly, it was doomed to failure at the very beginning. I would point out that my willingness to co-sponsor the first bipartisan budget in the history of the Budget Control Act, the Simpson-Bowles budget, would have addressed the whole sequester issue in a timely manner if people had been willing to understand that the time has come to stop the fighting and begin working together on resolving these issues. Now, as far as defense is concerned, the Simpson-Bowles budget plan calls for defense spending at gross domestic product minus 1% for the next 10 years. And that and those spending decisions would be left up to the Armed Services Committee on the authorization side and the Appropriations Committee on the appropriating side. But as again, the issue here is not what specific program you would address, but what is the big problem here? Remember, the Congress is controlled by Senator Harry Reid, who's a Democrat, and John Boehner, Speaker, who's a Republican, and the President, who's a Democrat. Two out of the three seats are held by Democrats. The only way to get to these big issues is to start with a budget. We have proposed in the House two budgets, and I've been the subject of nasty ads about that, my willingness to stand up and bring something to the table. There hasn't been a budget in the Senate for 3.5 years. That's not leadership.
I know,
Laura,
that,
if I could jump in
yes,
here, because this is definitely important. Congressman
Bass
loves to talk about the Simpson-Bowles plan, and I will acknowledge a broad approach like that is probably the direction we need to go. But the reality is he voted for the Ryan budget both before the Simpson-Bowles and within 24 hours of the Simpson-Bowles vote. And the Ryan budget has deep, deep cuts to everything we need to get the economy moving again. Education, innovation, infrastructure, roads, bridges, highways. We know how to get the economy going. We know you have to invest in opportunity today for prosperity tomorrow. And at the same time, the Ryan budget is not serious about cutting deficits because it adds an additional $265,000 tax break for millionaires. We can't afford that, and we have to get serious about deficit reduction.
And let's give you maybe 30
seconds. I only need
I'll give
15.
You 30. 30 right, seconds to respond, and then we'll go back
first
to
First of all,
Phil Lyon.
I voted for the Ryan budget within 30 minutes of the Simpson-Bowles budget because they all came up on the same day. The point is, Annie, it's time to get to the negotiating table and resolve these issues. I support the deficit control plans, not appropriations, not cuts. That's DCCC rhetoric. But it was a framework to reduce the size of government by approximately $6 trillion over the next 10 years. Bring it to the table. How can you bring it to the table if there's nothing coming from the Senate at all? So I also voted for a compromise budget, which I think will move the ball forward. And I guess you don't support this kind of compromise, which is regrettable. We've had enough of this in our corners, fighting with each other, not being willing to come to the table and work these problems out.
And we'll get to probably that theme again at least once, if not twice, during this debate. I do want to return to Phil Vaughn with a question on health care. Phil, go ahead. Yes.
Mr. Bass, you're part owner of a company in New Hampshire. How have the rising costs of health care affected your company, and what do you think should be done about it?
Well, first of all, I haven't been involved in the company now for well over 2 years, or a little less than 2 years, I guess. And so I don't know what – I'm not familiar with the internals, but health care costs are going up. And I guess if this is an entree into the whole issue of health care reform, as is well known, I have a very different view about where this nation should be headed in health care reform. And I believe that one of the biggest single impediments to economic recovery in this nation is the uncertainty that employers, many of whom are sitting here in front of us this morning, feel about what's going to happen next year and the year after when the new health care law takes effect. The one thing that is absolutely certain, and that is that health care premiums are not going to go down. The question is what's going to happen, and very few people know what's going to happen. The agencies have no idea what, how many thousands or tens of thousands of pages of regulations are going to come up, how these exchanges are going to work. It's the worst possible time to be completely revamping, whether you support the measure or not, the health care system in this country. And I would suggest that one of the quickest ways that we could start this economy turning in the opposite direction would be not to repeal necessarily, although I support that, but to at least defer the implementation of this health care, this new health care law, which is a bureaucratic boondoggle, until such time as the unemployment rate gets under control, say down by 2%. Because I can't tell you how many small businesses I've visited over the last 2 years who have said we're running second shifts and third shifts and overtime because we have no idea what the payroll burden is going to be, even if they have less than 50 employees. It's an enormous element of uncertainty. It represents a federalization of about a fifth of our entire U.S. economy. It's a move in the wrong direction, and I do have specific ideas about how we could have done it better.
What are those?
I'm sorry, can I just jump in there? Because as a small business shareholder myself, I've been in a law firm for 25 years, and we had double-digit increases year after year after year. It's unsustainable. Every small business in New Hampshire knows that. So the point is 96% of small businesses have employees under 50, and they won't be impacted at all. And the reality is that the inflation has dropped. The last couple of years, the studies are showing, are down to 2 or 3 or 4% healthcare inflation. What we really need to do is tackle the issue of cost of healthcare, and Congressman Bass has had no solution for that.
And I want to go back to Phil Vaughn. He's got another follow-up question for Mr. Bass on healthcare.
Mr. Bass, you said you had some specifics in mind.
I don't believe that the system that existed before is the best system we could possibly have. And I think 3 or 4 years ago, I wrote an op-ed outlining 6 or 7 different proposals that we could have undertaken. First of all, healthcare insurance is employer-based. There's no reason for that. It came about as a result of wage price controls after World War II. I think health insurance premiums should be universally deductible. So if you're working for yourself or working for a business, you get the same tax treatment. Secondly, I think we ought to open up the healthcare insurance market to other states. If the state of Massachusetts approves a healthcare plan, why can't we buy it in New Hampshire? Why can't we buy healthcare insurance the same way we buy automobile insurance, life insurance, homeowners insurance, every other kind of insurance? But it's stovepipe. And now we're taking it and putting it into the federal domain. So now Washington bureaucrats are going to set up the plan, or state bureaucrats, depending on where New Hampshire goes, and they're going to decide And it's not going to just affect companies that employ more than 50 people. There are provisions in the law that will reach into even smaller businesses, and there everybody is going to see a different environment for their health care, and I'm not sure it's going to be better.
You know, if I could just jump in, and then it'll be your turn, Ms. Custer. Mr. Bass, you said that the Affordable Care Act federalizes a large chunk of our economy, meaning the healthcare sector. And yet there are those on the other side who say, well, no, it's not federal at all. This is based on private markets and private insurance. They didn't go for the public option or the universal coverage that some liberals
Laura,
wanted.
And I'll be very brief here, too. You don't even need 15 seconds here. I think that health insurance companies and hospitals are going to turn into regulated utilities or the equivalent thereof through these exchanges. And whether that controls the cost or reduces the quality of service or whatever, who knows? My point is that we don't know what this new law is going to do. It certainly has a lot of new taxes, and there are a lot of good employers in this state who are going to pay higher taxes. I know one, for example, in Keene, Smith's Medical Device, the medical device tax, which is going to affect a number of employees. These are the kinds of things we just don't need. My point is, we don't need this new law right now.
Okay, and Phil to Ms. Custer, go ahead.
And you mentioned you're a partner in a law firm.
Yes.
What challenges have you faced over the years?
It's been about healthcare inflation that we just can't keep up, and no small business in New Hampshire. I've gone to small businesses all over the state, from tire companies in downtown Nashua all the way up to, you know, the paper mill in Gorham, and everyone is struggling. They want to be able to provide for their employees, and it's simply unaffordable and unsustainable. What I think we need to do is tackle the cost side of this issue. And we haven't gotten there, and the Republicans seem to have no solution for that. Basically, they're talking about privatization, which was where they love to go. They love to go there with Social Security. They love to go there with health care. But it's very, very expensive, because then the consumer is paying not just the administrative fees, but paying for marketing, paying for profit. And you're cutting into that health care dollar. What we need to do is focus not on volume of care, which is the way we pay now, but on the value of our care. So we need to focus on prevention, take those most expensive illnesses in our society, heart disease, diabetes, obesity, and make sure that we give people the preventative tools that they need to stay healthy. And that's what it's designed to do, is focus on wellness over just illness and injury. And frankly, there have been great successes. This research came right out of New Hampshire from Dartmouth, and it's been very effective.
And there are small businesses in New Hampshire who say that this mandate is going to be too expensive. They're not going to be able to afford it. I mean,
but any company under 50 does not have to participate, and companies, small businesses over 50 are already seeing the checks to help them pay for the insurance. The reality is, with 16 million people uninsured, we all pay. Those people show up at the emergency room. It's the most expensive place to get care, and frankly, the least effective in terms of preventative care that we all need. And so we pay in the cost shifting. I've been sitting down with hospital presidents all across this district, and every single one of them will tell you that it's unsustainable. We've got to find coverage for the uninsured so that the rest of us can afford care.
And super short to you, Ms. Custer, before we go back to Mike Cody. You said we need to tackle the cost side. One of the main critiques of the Affordable Care Act is that it does not tackle the cost side. It tackles access,
I agree,
but not cost.
I totally agree. Healthcare is a triangle. It's access, quality, and cost. And we need to go after cost. And this, by the way, is where my Republican roots come in. I think listeners know that I'm born bipartisan. My family was Republican when I was growing up. And I believe in the principles of competition. I believe that the consumer should have the option so that we can choose which setting is best for our health care. If we go to an outpatient clinic and get our health care at a lower cost, and we believe that the quality is sufficient, then we should engage in the savings in that. Right now, both the healthcare providers and the consumers are disengaged from the cost of care, and that's part of the problem.
All right, and let's turn back to Mike Cody from the union leader. Go ahead, Mike.
Ms. Custer, the state's manufacturing sector faces a constant shortage of workers with specialized skills. Is this skills gap a serious problem, and how do you ensure that they have the workers they need, the kind of workers they need?
Absolutely, and this is something that I've been working on in my own career for a long time. I've represented the New Hampshire College and University Council and worked with the business community, including many of the folks probably in this room, and listening to bring people together on the skills that are needed. There's a wonderful program in our community technical colleges where they sit down with the employer and determine what are the skill sets that the new jobs that they're able to bring in will need, and then they can focus the learning on those skill sets. But this is why I'm so concerned about this Ryan budget that Congressman Bass has voted for. 10 million students will lose their Pell Grants. Deep, deep cuts to research and development. Deep cuts. You've seen the state of New Hampshire already make a 50% cut to the university system budget. That's not sustainable for us to compete in the 21st century. And trust me when I say that China and India are not cutting their science, technology, engineering, and mathematics budgets. We've got to invest and keep up.
So how would the state keep companies here that need those workers? What would keep from moving some more?
Fortunately, New Hampshire workers are very talented, and it's one of the reasons that we have such a low unemployment rate compared to the rest of the country. I've been so impressed touring the manufacturing plants over in the Connecticut River Valley, for example, where workers are highly skilled in manufacturing. What I'm concerned about is that the incentives out of the Congress have been to ship jobs overseas. Congressman Bass has voted for tax breaks that reward companies that ship jobs overseas. I want to close those tax breaks, bring the companies and the jobs back here, and then help them invest in New Hampshire workers. And we need to see tax incentives for creating jobs right here at home. New Hampshire's lost 16,000 jobs to China. Actually, as a percentage of our population, it's number one in the country, and that's not what we want to be number one for. And that has to do with a vote that he took on this favorable nation trade to China. I want to make sure that we invest here at home in the companies, create this dynamic with education so that we have the workers trained for the jobs.
And real quickly, Mike, just to jump in, that's a direct comment towards you, Congressman Bass. So Ms. Custer says you voted for bills that encourage companies to ship jobs overseas. Have you done that?
Well, no, of course not. And, you know, this is kind of kabuki policy, kabuki accounting, the business of the 10 million people being off Pell Grants. That's the DCCC analysis where they take a budget number and they divide it out by all the programs, and then they select the one on an across-the-board basis that they think would be most devastating, and then they apply that number to it. Budgets don't do appropriations. They're not appropriations documents. I know this is why Harry Reid didn't want to have a budget in the Senate, because he didn't want the Republicans to be doing the same thing. But the reality is we've got a lead in this country, and we need to have a budget. Now, as far as the health care law is concerned, it was a I appreciate Annie's point that it doesn't do anything to control costs except establish a slush fund of $13 billion under the Secretary of Health and Human Services, which is subject to perpetual appropriation of $1 billion a year. So, lastly, on that tax breaks for moving companies offshore, there are no tax breaks for moving companies offshore. What's moving companies offshore is the fact that we don't have a competitive tax code. Our corporate rate is 35%. Canada just lowered its rate to 15%. We have the highest taxes in the world, and we tax income twice. That's where we need to get into tax reform
in order to get this economy turned around again. We've got to go back to Mike Cody with another question.
Back to the skills gap question, Mr. Bass. So what's the federal government's role in fixing that gap?
Well, I've supported retraining funds that have been important when some of our paper mills have closed down. I also worked when I was out of Congress on getting the old Burgess Mill up in Berlin converted into a renewable energy wood chip, 75 megawatt wood chip fired power plant that did involve some interaction with on the part of the management of the company with opportunities that may exist at the state and local area level for financing. You know, the relationship between an employer and its employees is a very special one, and it's not necessarily derived from Washington or some federal program. Small employers in this state look around the community. They look to the technical colleges, and they look to other places to provide education. In Keene, for example, CNS Wholesale Grocers has internal training programs so that they can recruit people into their companies, and they get to deduct those costs from their taxes. I certainly think it's important to have a level of federal involvement in retraining But the real relationship here is not the federal government providing the opportunity for the new job through some sort of a program from Washington. It's not non-existent, but it's a combination of these things. And it really involves employers. I've been involved with this. I'm a manufacturer myself. And we've gone out to look for people to work. And we work with technical schools and other schools in the area. I'll never forget when I first got involved in High Standard over in Dublin, New Hampshire. They had a program. It was a Carter-era program called CETA, Civilian Employment Training Administration. All you had to do was give somebody a hammer, and you got $50 from the federal government. That's not going to improve the economy. What really works are programs that arise and are run at a more local level and provide the necessary training that's needed to keep our employment force as vital as it is today. And we have low unemployment in this state for two reasons, or three reasons. One,
Mr. Best, I know, wrap it up.
We export. Number two, we have good, skilled labor.
So, Mr. Bass, who's to blame for this widening skills gap that we're facing?
Well, I'm not in the blame. I'm trying to stay away from the blame game. I haven't been entirely successful at that. The fact is that we have a bad economy that is based upon a lot of uncertainty, and it's hard for people to spend the time and resources that are necessary to be properly trained when the economy is bad and you're worried about food and education and so forth. So, you know, the number one goal here has to be to get this unemployment rate down below 8%, to get the deficits and the debt under control, and quite honestly, to stop fighting as Republicans and Democrats and start working together in the interests of the American people to turn this economy around.
And Ms. Custer, you wanted to jump
in. Well, I
just
want to say the unemployment rate in New Hampshire is 5.4%, and we still have the skills gap that you're talking about. So the reality is, I completely agree, the private sector is where jobs are created, but it's a partnership, and the community technical colleges can help to bridge this skills gap, but not with cutting Pell Grants by 10 million students. I mean, you just have got to invest in the next generation in order to stay competitive in this economy.
And I think in our long-form segment, we'll have a chance to dig into these concepts a little bit more. But that concludes this particular segment. We now move into the lightning round portion of our forum. This is where we ask a straightforward question that can be answered quickly and simply, as in yes or no. Extra points today for the candidate who is able to do that. Our first district candidates struggled with this a bit, so let's see how the second district contenders do. Our first lightning round questions come from Phil Vaughn. Phil, go ahead.
Ms. Custer, will the Federal Reserve's new plan to buy billions of dollars in mortgage bonds actually help the economy recover?
I believe it will.
It's going to be hard because interest rates are already so low. Buying back long-term Treasury notes that are only 1 or 2% interest above what the short-term notes are don't really provide that much incentive. The real problem is not with the Federal Reserve. They've done everything they can. It's with the administration and the Congress and the Senate not providing economic leadership.
But in answer to your question, I think the Federal Reserve needed to act and keep interest rates low. We all know that for how that's going to help consumers and everyday Americans, and I think it was an important step.
Mr. Bass, should the Social Security retirement age be raised? And if so, to what age?
I believe that the whole issue of Social Security solvency should be a matter of what I would consider to be a very big debate that includes both parties, Republicans and Democrats. The Social Security Administration, the Social Security Trust Fund is not going to make it through the generation Annie's and my generation without some sort of reform. And I believe that in the course of this debate, every issue should be on the table,
including raising the age.
It should be on the table, including raising the retirement age, including making the benefits structure work better. And I call on my Democratic colleagues to be willing to come to the table and say, I'm willing to listen.
And
to
Mr. Best, in the spirit of the lightning round.
Sorry, 30 seconds.
In the spirit
seconds.
Of the lightning Ms. round, Custer, a very quick response.
Yes, and I want to get to you. I just want to clarify, Mr. Bass. So you're saying maybe.
I am saying that the only way we're going to save this program for future generations is to have a plan that both parties can agree on, and the only way you're going to get to that is to be willing as individuals to be, say that you will put every single issue on the table.
Okay, custom.
The truth
is
there's a very quick fix. It's a bipartisan fix. If we simply increase the cap from $106,000, because as it is now, middle-class families pay 100% on the Social Security withholding tax, and wealthy people do not. They pay a mere fraction of their income.
So don't raise
And so
the
it's
age.
A very fixed, we don't need to. We don't need to change okay. the age. It's a very quick fix, and it'll be sustainable indefinitely.
All right. We'll keep it lightning-ish.
Yes.
You started off good.
I did great. He jumped in on me.
Go ahead, Mike Cody.
Ms. Custer, President Obama has accused China of unfairly subsidizing car exports. Has the administration done enough to protect businesses against unfair trade practices from China?
Again, this is my concern, and I think they can do more. I'm glad they jumped in on the issue about the tires. I'm glad they're jumping in on the issue about the cars. What I'm concerned about is New Hampshire losing 16,000 jobs, and I think Congressman Bass is on record with this special trade status for China that is really very threatening for us.
So the administration itself, though, the White House could do more.
Absolutely.
Mr. Bass.
Good point, Laura. The trade vote that Annie refers to was one that was cast, I think, over a decade ago. And it's important because it makes sure it assures to the greatest extent possible that China plays by our rules, not the other way around. But I do agree that such issues as the currency debate ought to be resolved. And I frankly condemn this administration during the 4 years of doing virtually nothing proactive to deal with the issue of China competition.
Okay. Mike.
Mr. Bass, the U.S. Postal Service is losing about $50 million a day. It's proposed cutting Saturday service to save money. Do you agree?
Well, first of all, I break here with my Republican colleagues on this issue. I think that the biggest problem the Postal Service faces is the miscalculation by the Office of Personnel Management on their retirement contribution.
And that came up yesterday,
but
too.
But once you take that issue and put it aside, which I think they should do, you still have the Postal Service running at a loss.
So should we cut
and
Saturday
again,
service?
I think that that we should have a combination of different issues, including reducing service, but also potentially changing the structure of postal rates so that they're more competitive with other services where things are moved by mail?
My answer is no.
Shouldn't cut Saturday service. Okay. Our next round of lightning round questions come from Phil Vaughn. Go ahead, Phil.
Ms. Custer, how do you define middle class? And you can give us an income range.
I would say the hardworking families right here in New Hampshire are almost entirely middle class. I was interested to see that these people that earn $1 million in income, because I was trying to understand who would be hurt by the Ryan budget, and New Hampshire families are 99.9% below that. So it's 0.1%, 349 people in my district.
So what's
so the middle
amount?
Class for me? I mean, I think most people consider themselves to be middle class if they're making, anything maybe up to $100,000 with two incomes. But even some people with incomes over that, if they have children going to college, my husband and I find these college tuition payments to be breathtaking.
So what's the low end? Would you say 50 to 100,000 or?
On the low end, again, it would depend how many people are in the family mm-hmm. because, you know, there are people that are making 25 or 30, but they're single and they feel quite comfortable.
Okay, so, Mr. Bass, yeah.
Well, I have to agree with Annie not only on that, but also on the fact that the college tuitions are breathtaking.
We're both in the middle of that.
But the reality is I define somebody who's in the middle class as a dual-income household, people who are two or three paychecks away from bankruptcy if they get laid off, absolutely terrified about the fact that unemployment has been over 8.5% nationwide now for 4 years, and that there's no end in sight for this economic recession. And I think these are the key people who are going to decide whether or not we have more of the same, the new normal, no economic recovery over the next 2 or 4 years, or whether we try something
any
different.
Or worse yet, go back to the Bush era economic
Ms. Custer,
policies.
Lightning round, and any dollar amount there, Congressman Bass.
50, I believe the income average for New Hampshire is somewhere around 50,000 right now. So Annie's right in that respect.
Okay, go ahead, Phil.
Mr. Bassey, you've both touched on this in the past, but a bipartisan group, including Judd Gregg, is working on a new Simpson-Bowles reduction plan, debt reduction plan. If that plan includes a tax increase on the middle class, would you oppose it?
First of all, I commend former Senator Judd Gregg and others of my colleagues, including me, although I'm on the periphery right now because I'm obviously involved in a campaign for the next 49 days. I believe that the effort to reduce or to find a bipartisan solution to these big issues has got to be the top priority. It doesn't have to include a tax increase on the middle class. What it will include is a simplification of tax rates, increases in some, but most likely not
so
on earned income,
it,
and
reduction. If it had any would, tax increase in the middle class?
Absolutely. But that's a hypothetical.
We do not need to increase taxes on the middle class.
I find it very unlikely that it will include something
it's
like that.
It's wealthy people that need to pay their fair share.
Next round of lightning round.
Yes.
Should the federal government subsidize wind power?
You know, this word subsidy is interesting because the federal government is subsidizing fossil fuels to an extent that is unsustainable and we cannot afford it. Again, Congressman Bass has voted over the years for oil and gas subsidies, $40 billion for subsidies for coal and nuclear. And by the way, as an aside, and again, not to be personal, but these are just the facts, his campaign is funded almost entirely with contributions from those type of companies.
Okay.
My feeling about wind
Ms.
power
Custer,
and all of
the
these
question,
is
please.
That we need to level the playing field and that we should have no subsidies for any energy at all in order to have competition. But if we can't get rid of the oil and gas subsidies that we can't afford, then we need to create a level playing field.
Please, Ms. Custer. I'm so sorry to do that to you, but we're running out of
time. The reason that renewable energy doesn't get off the ground is not because they're not great ideas and they don't work, but it's because financially they're not viable because of all the tax breaks for fossil fuels.
Okay, and let's get Congressman Bass in on this.
Sure. First of all, Annie, my campaign was not funded almost entirely by any group. You know that. The total amount of money that I have received in 14 years now is less than 1% of the total amount of money that I've received, about $114,000. That Democrat report that came out includes Peterborough Oil Company and Johnson and Dix, and then they added an extra 20% on top of that. That's different from the national liberal money bundlers who have put hundreds of thousands of dollars into your campaign
support. What about the wind subsidies?
Well, wind subsidies are important.
I would point out two
things. First of all, a plan to have the General Accountability Office do a complete study of all of these subsidies. Right now in America, wind is getting the biggest subsidy of all, of any energy source. I'm not necessarily opposed to that. I support Cape Wind, and I've written letters to the Ways and Means Committee in support of continuing the investment and or the production tax credit for wind generation.
Okay, and that concludes our lightning round, a light round of lightning. We appreciate both of you, your passion and your interest in the issues. We're going to move on to the other part of our forum. This is a longer, moderated discussion. I'll ask the candidates one broad question and then encourage them to get a dialogue going on this question and see where it takes us. I will jump in as needed to make sure that we're on target with the topic itself or the time. And the question to both of you is, President Obama was roundly criticized for his "you didn't build that" comment this summer. It's led to debates over how much credit government or business each deserve for economic growth in America. Now that's what we want to discuss for about the next 8 or 9 minutes. To kick it off though, I want to give you each 1 minute and then I encourage you to share ideas and talk about it. So Ms. Custer, we'll start this segment with you. Again, the question, how much credit do government or business deserve for economic growth in America?
Well, I absolutely believe that it's the private sector that creates jobs. I've been in the private sector for the last 25 years, and actually since the last campaign, I've created my own business, Newfound Strategies, which is a consulting company for nonprofit fundraising. But I believe that the government does create an environment for businesses to grow. That's what tax policy is all about. The types of tax breaks that Congressman Bass has voted for fossil fuels were encouraging the production of fossil fuel energy. I believe that what we need to do is give incentives such as growing the economy here at home and the incentives for shipping jobs overseas. I think we need to end the uncertainty. He keeps talking about uncertainty. Truly, the uncertainty flows from the deficit. We've got to be serious about the deficit because companies are not investing. They're not making capital investments or investment in people because of their concerns. So there's any number of things that the government can do, but I absolutely believe that it's the private sector that drives job growth.
What do you think, Congressman Bass? Well, how much credit?
When I heard that statement, you know, my first reaction was I was offended. You know, I used to, back in the early 80s, drive a 16-foot straight with panels in it down to deliver to, you know, chalkboard companies down in Massachusetts. My brother and I struggled to make our business work successfully. And I don't quibble with the idea that the system of taxes and also certain government programs, Small Business Administration, and, you know, R&D tax credit on the other side, and the expensing of capital equipment, they all matter. They count, and they are important. Annie's right about that. But the biggest problem that business faces right now is an explosion of the federal government and the regulators getting into everything. I can tell you about a business over on the Connecticut River Valley. This family is in the business of smoking meats and cheeses. And they have had a federal bureaucrat, or at least during August they did, in that office for 3 straight weeks. Looking over their shoulder. There wasn't any reason for that. This is a family, and certainly they have to comply with sanitary conditions, which the state already regulates, but this is the kind of thing that the federal government is doing, and it's creating an element of fear. It's almost as if this federal government thinks that government, that business is a necessary evil in society that provides revenue to fund more and more government. And businesses get going by entrepreneurs who take risks and work very hard. And I think it's the president's assumption, and I think it's subliminal, that government is responsible for the economy is really wrong.
Well, I have to say that the truth is the federal government grew during the 8 years of the Bush administration 7.7%, and during the now 3.5, almost 4 years of the Obama administration, only 1.7%. So I agree that the federal government is too big, but I think you're laying that in the wrong era. What I believe is that small businesses do grow from entrepreneurial spirit. There's no question. We both know entrepreneurs that have had terrific ideas and been very, very successful. But even as you started telling that story, you used to drive the truck. Who built the roads? Who put the bridges? Who built the highways? And I think it's basic civics that people, practical people, common sense New Hampshire voters understand. You know, we've had these free staters come into the state and they don't want any government at all. And my view is, fine, bring your grievances to Concord, but don't drive on our highways. It's the reality is businesses need an educated workforce that's primarily from the public schools, from the public university, from the public community technical colleges. Granted, it's a public-private partnership. That's what I've spent my career doing, bringing people together from the business community, from the nonprofit community, and to the extent that it's necessary to have legislation. Often it's not. The two projects that I like to cite that I've worked on were the Medication Bridge Program and the College Savings Program. Neither of those required any government expenditure, not a single tax dollar, and it helped to distribute free medicine to families and help families, middle-class families, save for college. In both cases, the business sector stepped up. And we can do this. We can bring people together. It doesn't matter if an idea is Republican or Democrat. We don't need to ask
that. Jump in, and I want to let Congressman Bass jump in, too. Many businesses were upset by that comment, you didn't build it.
I think it was taken entirely out of context. And honestly, I think a lot more Americans are going to be upset by the comments of Governor Romney when they hear them about 47% of the American people mooching off the government. That's not true, clearly. People are hardworking. I've been all over the state in hardworking families. But look, so are firefighters and teachers and policemen, hardworking people. And I think they've been maligned by some of the arguments that have been made.
Congressman Bass, yeah, go ahead.
Well, there's this attitude in Washington that has arisen over the last 4 years, that government is the answer to everything. And I'm a principled Republican, and Annie and I have a difference of opinion. I certainly think there's a role for government in providing the necessary incentives to move the economy in one direction or another, but not everything. And when President Obama says that, you know, that the government is basically responsible for the vitality of the economy and the hard work of small business people and big business people, for that matter, and employees, and everything is based on Washington, I think it's a sad day for America. And we're a country that's based on entrepreneurship and opportunity. And to the extent that the federal government can provide some incentives and so forth, I think that's helpful. But the problem that we have right now is that businesses are struggling and they're going nowhere. Annie makes reference to Governor Romney's remarks yesterday. I agree with her. I think every American wants to do better in the world, but it's awful hard when the government when the size of the U.S. government goes up by $1 trillion in 4 years, when the debt of this country goes up by $5 trillion, which was more than the whole debt of the nation in its history when I entered Congress in 1995, when the only platform that this president has for economic recovery is about limiting tax deductions for retraining for companies that may be moving out of the country, and also raising taxes on small businesses and sub-S corporations that are the source of most of the economic vitality in this state, and not to reduce the deficit, but to pay for even more government. Where does this all end?
Well, here's a question I'm curious about. Where do the two of you see perhaps eye to eye on this role of government and business working together to boost overall prosperity for everybody? What do you think, Congressman Bass?
Well,
where do you and Ms. Custer?
Well, Laura, this is supposed to be
this.
A debate. You're not supposed to be asking this.
Where, I know, but everybody says they want Congress to come together. Everybody says they're tired
of
bickering.
Well, the truth is, it's not as though, I mean, Congressman Bass is acting as though the government is the entire problem. The government is not the entire problem. So I don't believe that the government is the entire solution. I think we both support entrepreneurship. We both support small business. That's the heartbeat, the backbone of the New Hampshire economy.
Okay.
And where
okay.
we differ yep. is that I
Super
just don't
short,
think
yep.
we need tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires that we can't afford. We need to take the deficit seriously, bring the deficit down so that companies can grow.
Again, I think the whole politics of envy in this campaign is really a sad chapter in politics. And I would only suggest that I have said over and over again, bring it to the table. If President Obama and Annie Custer's idea for reviving this economy, reducing the deficit, and putting people back to work is raising taxes on sub-S corporations and individuals who have incomes of more than $200,000 a year, fine, bring it to the table. I'll consider it. But show me where you're going to find the $4 trillion to get this budget balanced in the next 10 years.
All right.
And we certainly won't with $1 trillion in new tax breaks.
Well, thank you very much for that conversation. I appreciate it. And I want to move to our final segment. That's all the time we have for that segment. We're going to return to our panelists for a few final questions. Now, for these, each of you will have 1 minute. If there's a follow-up question, 30 seconds. And for that first round, that last round, we begin with Phil Vaughn. Phil, go ahead.
Ms. Custer, do you think any changes in federal immigration laws are needed to benefit New Hampshire's business community?
What I've heard about mostly from the business community in terms of the immigration are the high-end technical employees that they would like to be able to bring to New Hampshire, as well as, frankly, in the agricultural sector. I know there's an issue about bringing in part-time work. I live on a road in Hopkinton of an apple orchard, and I know that we need to bring people in for picking. But in general, I have not heard of any immigration issues in New Hampshire. I think New Hampshire has a long, long history in the mills and otherwise of welcoming immigrants. My family were immigrants, came here from Scotland building cabinets and went on to have a successful and enjoyed life here in New Hampshire. And I think we're very welcoming of the people who are coming here.
And I will go to Phil again, and then you'll get a chance, Congressman Bass. Yeah, go ahead.
Both parties are working on a bill to give more green cards to foreign students graduating in science technology. Why are we doing this, and what about American workers?
Well, my son, Travis, my younger son, is an engineering student, and I want to encourage that. Started actually from a public-private partnership here in New Hampshire where the community technical school came into the public schools and helped to get them started on engineering in the seventh grade. And I think that's the type of program we need to encourage, because New Hampshire students are well capable of having careers in engineering and science and technology and math,
okay,
but they need the training and the education for it.
Okay, Phil.
Mr. Bass, same question. Do you think any changes in federal immigration laws are needed to benefit?
Well, first of all, there is an immigration issue. Annie started to touch on it a little bit. But if you're in the hospitality industry or the landscaping business, you can't find guest workers during the summer because the system doesn't work, because it has a 60,000 individual cap, and all the tourist industry pick up those individuals during the wintertime. I propose two things. First of all, in both H-1B and H-2B, one's guest worker, one's highly skilled, that once you get to America and you're properly sponsored and you're here legally with your sponsors, and then you, in the case of a guest worker or a high-skilled worker, you're called upon to return. If the need is still there, you can remain and do a second tour or third tour. Mm-hmm. What this does is it creates a path to citizenship that's legal. I oppose illegal immigration, and I don't support it. Some businesses do, I don't. But there is a way to do this, and that is to allow the H-1Bs and the H-2Bs to become citizens the legal way. And a change like that would relieve the immigration or the workforce issue that we have in New Hampshire with temporary workers and also at the high-skilled end.
Go ahead, Phil, real quick.
And the same follow-up question regarding the increase in green cards for foreign students. Are there not enough American students?
Well, I think, first of all, the increase in green card students for foreign highly skilled foreign individuals. Remember, these people are educated for the most part in New Hampshire education system, in the higher education system. And then what do? We send them back to their native countries, force them to go and tell them, and then we complain about outsourcing.
So it's a good job.
I think it's a good idea, and the market ought to be able to compete.
Okay, and last question from you, Mike, and super short, 30, maybe even under, would be good.
The clock is our enemy. Right?
Mr. Bass, give me an example of New Hampshire business you would consider socially responsible and why.
Timberlane.
I agree with Timberlane, Stonyfield. There are many socially responsible businesses. What I love about New Hampshire is this public-private partnership. Every single nonprofit that I've served on in New Hampshire, there are many business people serving. And I think they find, as we did at Rath & Young, at our law firm, that it's great training, and it's the way to make a really high-quality life for both the business community and people's lives.
Ms. Custer, you got a little extra time there, so you want a super short tell us why Timberlane?
Yeah, I think that businesses that care about the communities, that are parts of their local civic organizations, that have a real civic involvement, are important, because just employing people and making profits is not everything. And so there are many, many
All
businesses
right.
in our region.
We should add Lincoln
same.
Financial for having us here today.
Well, both of you, thank you very much for being here. That is all the time that we have. And I want to thank you, our audience, for joining us here at the Institute of Politics. And to you, of course, at home, watching and listening. And especially, thank you again to our candidates, Republican incumbent Congressman Charlie Bass and Democratic challenger Ann McClain Custer. Thanks a lot for being here.
From the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College, this is the Candidate Forum on Business and the Economy, sponsored by Lincoln Financial Group, produced in partnership with the Business and Industry Association of New Hampshire, New Hampshire Union Leader, New Hampshire Public Radio, and New Hampshire Public Television.
The Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 on NHPR. New Hampshire weather for today, clouding up, turning windy with showers developing. Highs today, 65 to 70 degrees. Tonight, cloudy, rain heavy at times, windy with some strong wind gusts possible. Lows tonight from 55 to 60 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Antioch University, New England in Keene, offering master's programs in counseling and dance movement therapy. Information.